Try Therapy Notes, the number one rated electronic health record system available today. With live telephone support 7 days a week, it's clear why Therapy Notes is rated 4.9 out of 5 stars on Trustpilot and has a 5-star rating on Google. Therapy Notes makes billing, scheduling, note-taking, and telehealth incredibly easy. And now, for all you prescribers out there, Therapy Notes is proudly introducing ePrescribe. Try it today with no strings attached and see why everyone is switching to Therapy Notes, now featuring ePrescribe. You can get 2 months free by using promo code CHAT at therapynotes.com. Trauma Therapist Network is a website to learn about trauma and how it shows up in our lives and to find a trauma therapist. Go to traumatherapistnetwork.com to find a trauma therapist near you today. Therapy Chat Podcast, episode 455.
This is the Therapy Chat Podcast with Laura Reagan, LCSWC. The information shared in this podcast is not a substitute for seeking help from a licensed mental health professional. And now, here's your host, Laura Reagan, LCSWC.
Hi, welcome back to Therapy Chat. I'm your host, Laura Reagan, and today I'm bringing you a conversation with a friend and colleague who I recently connected with face-to-face for the first time for this interview. My guest is Erin Sparr, who is known on Instagram as Feminist Mom Therapist. Erin Sparr is a licensed therapist, mother, feminist, podcast host, and maternal mental health advocate based in Raleigh, North Carolina. Erin uses a feminist lens in her work with mothers and strives to help mothers free themselves from oppressive societal expectations and find more self-confidence and self-compassion. She hosts the Feminist Mom podcast, where she discusses the intersection of feminism and motherhood with inspiring guests. Erin recently launched the Inclusive Provider Directory, a directory that serves as a vital link connecting mothers, birthing individuals, and families in the U.S. and Canada with perinatal providers who prioritize inclusivity and identity-affirming care. Erin sees clients in her private practice, which is available to folks in North Carolina and Maryland, and she lives in Raleigh, North Carolina with her husband and two kids. We had a pretty far-reaching conversation about how moms are impacted by patriarchal structures, how limited our cultural view of motherhood is, and why so many moms are so fed up. We got into a lot of stuff, and I hope you will enjoy listening. Let's get started. Hi, welcome back to Therapy Chat. I'm your host, Laura Reagan, and today I'm so excited to be speaking with Erin Sparr, LCPC. Erin, thank you so much for being my guest on Therapy Chat today.
Laura, this is such a treat. Thank you so much for having me. I'm really happy to be here.
You're welcome. We've connected on Instagram. We were first connecting because we were going to be attending there was a women's march in like 2022, the second big one in DC, although we didn't actually meet there. But now we have finally connected, and I already feel very comfortable with you because we started chatting beforehand and shared a lot in common. So today we're going to talk about you, your work, feminism, intersectional feminism. And before we get into it, can you start off with just telling everybody a little bit more about who you are and what you do?
Yeah, sure. So I pretty much work with moms. In the last kind of 10 years or so, after I had my first child, who is almost 12 next week, I, you know, was a therapist who I'd only been practicing for like a year before I got pregnant, and just was like completely blown away by how challenging motherhood was. And so my own experience and then talking to moms really kind of ignited a passion in me for working with, you know, the perinatal period. And, you know, way back, you know, before grad school, I always had an interest in sociology. I was a sociology minor. So I didn't go into the social work route, but I did like the clinical psychology route and kind of combined that with sociology. So, because you're social work,
I was
right?
a sociology bachelor's major.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah. I found like that to be so much more interesting, to be honest, in my psychology classes.
I thought the exact same thing. It made more sense.
It made so much sense to kind of understand how our culture and how our systems are like, you know, organized in order to kind of oppress some groups and, you know, to
elevate others,
power to others. Exactly. And so once you kind of see that, it's really powerful. And so that's been kind of a lens that I've carried and, you know, took a lot of classes in college on like African-American social thoughts that they talked about a lot and kind of became really interested in racism, structural racism, just try as a white woman with privilege, really, you know, being open to and trying to understand how, you know, Black people were kind of navigating our racist society. That was something I was really interested in. So then when I became a therapist, I didn't have this like feminist lens until working with moms. I wouldn't say I wasn't a feminist. I was always probably a feminist, but I really like identified with it as I would sit with mothers who were coming in because they had postpartum anxiety and they had rage and they had like burnout symptoms. And a lot of it is really easy to trace back to patriarchy and how that impacts our whole system, our whole society, and how we treat women and mothers specifically. And we can talk about kind of what it is about mothers that feels particularly challenging, but also how that impacts relationships. And I see the same patterns over and over again. So I kind of started to really identify with the feminist part of my identity and really bringing that into my work with clients. But then also I have a platform that I've been growing on Instagram. And that's a place where I really talk a lot about my observations and things that I'm noticing and talking about with my clients.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's a pretty big platform you are building. You have many tens of thousands of followers on Instagram. So your message is really getting out to a number of people, and that's so valuable.
Yeah. Thank you.
Moms need to hear and see. I think being a woman and being a mother, you are so bombarded with so many things that it can be hard to even see which way is up. And, you know, maybe might seem easier to focus on things like trying to present a certain image in public instead of the, you know, the fears of your kids going to school and not being safe, or, you know, just looking at your kids and worrying about how they'll do in life with, if you have daughters, if they'll be safe, and if you have sons, if they'll be safe, and if they'll be, you know, not wanting them to be violent people towards other people, you know, I mean, just as some of the tiny, tiny, huge things that we're focusing on. I know one of the things that we had talked about discussing was the burden that women carry in families. And I guess all the labor that women do, the weight of being female. And that's something that I think brings a lot of women to therapy. And then often they're even, it's sort of like the structural impression is, well, you've lost yourself in caregiving, as if it's a character defect instead of something that is so, can swallow you. The demands of caregiving, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's been the case for a long time, that women, mothers have been carrying the sort of bulk of the labor and the mental load, as we talk about now. And I think we're in this really interesting time period, kind of post the second wave, third wave feminism, where, you know, there was this real effort to help women get out of the domestic sphere if they wanted to, right? That many women felt trapped in their roles. And so now, you know, a lot of my peers, we were raised kind of feeling like we had options, that we could work, we could be mothers, but we could also have careers. And I think we're at this place right now where a lot of women are realizing, like, wait, we got this opportunity that maybe our grandmothers or great grandmothers didn't have, but nobody really took off the load.
There was no adjustment.
There was right. And it's been interesting because I've had some reels about this on Instagram. One particular goes viral. And so I get these comments. And there was one that really struck me from this one man who said, like, we never agreed to women going into the workforce. You guys wanted this. And so now, like, you're expecting
us. He said it.
You wanted
now
it.
We know. We didn't want this. You wanted this. Now you got it. So you got to deal with it and still do everything that you were doing before.
And that a lot of women are married or in relationship, let's say with men, if they're in heterosexual partnerships, where men aren't saying that out loud, but there is an undertone or their behavior is showing that. And I think that we're in this like reckoning here where a lot of women are getting burnout and then they're getting angry, right? And they're saying, wait a second, in order to come out of this burnout, I have to find space. I have to take up space. I have to push back. And I don't think we've done a great job of preparing men as a society to expect like women to do that and to know how to kind of rise up to meet that challenge. In a lot of ways, there's not a lot of it. Real incentive to do that or real modeling of what that looks like.
Our culture is just not set up for women not to be in the one down position. It's set up that we are the domestic work and it's very hard to get by on a one income family nowadays. I mean,
yes.
Certainly where we live in Maryland, it's one of the most expensive states to live, but things are going up everywhere. And it takes two incomes to get by for most families. But
right.
Then who's doing all the other stuff? And it's falling on the moms.
And we know that. And we have like research that really shows that. I think that's interesting because part of what can be hard is a lot of times there was some research that showed that women underestimated how much they were doing in the home domestic sphere while men overestimated. And part of that is because a lot of the labor that I see women mothers do when they're the default parent, the she-fall parent, as you could say, is the mental load, the sort of internal invisible work of kind of like running a company, running a business, running any kind of organization that takes looking ahead, it takes planning, it takes calculating, it takes worrying, it takes, you know, figuring out who's going to do what. And anticipating, prepping. A lot of men who are doing better than their fathers and grandfathers because they're showing up more, they're present. I see wonderful dads who are dropping their kids off at school in the morning or at the bus stop, who are, you know, present in a way that is definitely progress. But a lot of them, because they're doing that active work, not everyone's doing that. I talked to lots of folks who are in relationships where it's not like that. But I'm saying
yeah.
that even in the best.
For those who are.
But they often are, a lot of those men walk around with the like good dad sticker on their shoulder, by the way, which is like they get the super dad award, which we don't give to women who are doing more work than that. Right. But a lot of men say, hey, I did this thing and this thing and this thing. And they miss all of the mental invisible work that women are doing, which then leads women to kind of sometimes undermine ourselves. Like how we were talking earlier, just like am I overreacting? Should I expect, you know, all of these like kind of internal ways that we can undermine our own pain and suffering.
But it's like preemptively because The message is, don't be a nag. Stop complaining, you know, and our cultural message that we get is that we're supposed to look a certain way. We're supposed to act. We're supposed to be nice. We're supposed to be sweet. We're supposed to be small. Our bodies have to be small. We have to be pretty. We have to appear youthful. We have to be fun and light. I mean, probably anybody who's been on social media has come across at least once that 1950s guidebook for how a housewife should treat her husband when he comes home from work. Greet him with a cocktail. Don't trouble him with the problems of your day. Keep the children quiet and clean so he doesn't feel bad when he sees them. And it's like all this attending to the husband in a heterosexual relationship. But I think even in same gender relationships and non-heteronormative relationships, sometimes those dynamics still come up because this is a culture that everyone is born into. So it's like this sort of being responsible for the man's, or the man in the relationships, the masculine energy of the relationship's emotional needs and the kids' emotional needs, and don't have emotional needs to be taken care of from them because they're too tired. They work so hard and they're trying so much and they drop the kids off at school. Like, what do you want? Never satisfied. Yeah. No.
And we don't, in patriarchy, we don't let men and like little boys who like to express the full range of emotions, right? This is where we say patriarchy, this is not about hating men. This is about like, we're all harmed.
And it harms all of us.
In different ways, right? But like men often don't know what to do with emotions when we bring them up in relationships and say like, hey, like I'm really struggling. A lot of men go to shame. They go to, you're telling me I'm a bad boy, basically. Their inner child's like, I'm being scolded. And they go to protection of that, of like, either by lashing out or by going like sort of withdrawing.
Defending themselves,
right? Because it's intolerable to hear that critique, or that even if it's a call for help. And so I see that dynamic a lot where women are trying to say, I'm overwhelmed, like I need more. But men are hearing, I'm being attacked by this nag, this, you know, who has unrealistic expectations and all of that. And so there's so much defending of that rather than, you know, being able to like hear it, attend to it, go toward it.
Seeing it as like both people's problem.
Yeah. A relational problem, which is, you and I know, like, the whole thing is being able to have a relationship. And I think we haven't prepared like any of us really, but I do think women are socialized more toward relationships and talking about feelings and feeling responsible really for the relationship in our culture.
Yeah. And, you know, another thing I was thinking of, and it's like, I remembered it and I forgot it when I started to bring it up. But when you shared about yourself realizing when you became a mom, just why feminism is important, or, you know, how important it is, like a deeper understanding that you knew before. But I see so many therapist moms who literally are basically full-time working business owners who also are full-time parents. They put their whole work into the time that their children are in school or preschool. And it's like they're always available for whoever needs them. They're available for their clients fully. And then as soon as their kid is home or is going to be coming home, they're there. And they just like, they turn off therapists and they turn on mom, and they're making food and they're shuttling people to different places and hearing about their day and signing field trip permission slips and all that stuff. And all it takes is one little like glitch in the flow of the plan, the process, to make the whole thing tumble down. And then the woman is saying, you know, oh, I'm letting my kids down, or why couldn't I do this? And I mean, it's incredible what we now expect women to do. And what we expect of ourselves as women, to be able to do. But the burden, the weight of it is so, it's really detrimental.
Oh my goodness. Yes. I mean, I think part of what I hear you talking about is that we're in this period that's called the intensive mothering period, where the expectations of parenting in general, but mother specifically, have really never been higher, right? Like, if we think about the 1950s housewife, who, like, our culture is really based on having, she, first of all, wasn't as happy as the trad wives on Instagram make it seem. But she, like, we tend to romanticize, or some people are romanticizing that right now. That's a whole side note. But I feel like she was, you know, on the phone. She was talking to neighbors. She was maybe taking care of the house, making sure food was made, drinking, taking Quaaludes or whatever.
Quaaludes or the Lexatrim or whatever the speed diet pill was that used to keep people going.
Yep. And, you know, as far as the emotional and mental health of her kids, like, that was not even on, that wasn't part of the job, right? The way that now we've learned a lot about child development, and we're, you know, which is great, we're having a more understanding of what kids need psychologically. But again, we're adding things to our plate without that community support. In a lot of ways, we've lost it. I mean, sometimes the 1950s housewife maybe had neighbors running, looking after kids who are running around, right? There was more
extended family nearby.
Yeah, exactly. So we've lost the village, right? Because we've all, you know, moved and on all of that into different places for careers because of the economy, all the reasons. And then the expectations now are not just feed them 3 meals a day, but feed them organically and, you know, be listening to Dr. Becky and going on Instagram and learning how to parent consciously and gentle parent and, you know, all of the expectations, again, that women are feeling. And I think we, of course, there's like this whole setting of perfectionism that I think a lot of, I know you're more Gen X. I'm like an elder millennial, you know, Xennial. A lot of millennials, I feel like, were really set up for perfectionism with a lot of like external behavioral like approaches, which I feel like Gen X was sort of neglected, right? Like,
you got that right. We were on our own. We just ran streets. We ran around the woods. We were doing anything. Nobody knew where we were or thought about it all day long.
Yep.
No babysitter.
As a reaction to that, I think a lot of millennials were raised with more helicopter parenting, definitely more focus on like achievement and like getting into school, I guess, in particular socioeconomic, you know, groups, of course.
Success and stuff.
Success, right? All these ways. So like, here's an A, here's a, you know, an F, the good, bad. So there was much more reliance on external feedback. And then when you become a mom, and especially if you have, you know, had a career or whatever, where maybe you tried to get that external feedback, you get, you know, promotion or something, like, a lot of moms then don't know how to figure out how well they're doing as in their role. And they look at social media and they compare themselves and they say, well, this, you know, the pediatrician said I'm supposed to do it this way, and so I have to do it the perfect way, the ideal way, right? So there's just like so much pressure. And again, like, a dad is still a good dad if he's involved. Right. If you think about just that word involved, he's an involved dad. People say that all the time. Could you imagine saying that about a mother? Like, she's an involved mother. Like, that's the bare minimum.
Yeah. Like, not absent. That's all that says. Right. I was right there. I was standing right there. I showed up.
Right. So there's just
and
still
then what
so
did you do?
Yeah. Right. And then I think I see a lot of women mothers who they're not just reacting, they're going to therapy to heal their intergenerational trauma, right? They're trying to not pass down certain things or parenting differently than their parents did. And a lot of men haven't gotten that message. They don't see their peers doing that kind of work to sort of say, like, I'm not saying all, okay. And we're talking in generalizations, we're talking in just sort of trends. So I'm sure there are some men who are, and if there are men listening to this podcast, like, maybe that's not, you know, who we're talking about. But I do see that a lot of folks who then their partners will react parent-wise. They'll just sort of do what feels natural to them then, while the women who are in therapy and they're listening to the podcast and they're reading their books are trying to be more intentional in certain ways. And then, there again, there's more clashing of, like, in the relationship. So anyway, to that kind of topic.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I mean, it's like resonating with me. I'm thinking about my own parenting since my kids are out of the house now. I think, you know, different generations. And I was a Gen X young parent, but I was very perfectionistic because I wanted to do better.
Yeah.
I wanted to break generational cycles of trauma before I knew what that was called. And, you know, I wanted to do anything but be like the ways that didn't work for me when I was growing up. So maybe I was a little bit of an early helicopter, you know, adopter, but trendsetter, if you will. But no, but I mean, what you said, I think it struck a chord when you said about men not seeing their peers really working to develop their emotional lives and their parenting skills and to not be reactive. I mean, you know, I'm sure I see in my practice, you know, and I love men. I have a son. I'm not anti-men at all, but I've observed in my life that men have, you know, pretty much you can be angry or you can be neutral. Even like joyful isn't allowed in the patriarchy construct, and scared is definitely not welcome. Tender, you know, tenderness, like softness, gentleness. I mean, you hear it right now in our political discourse. How many people are screaming all over the internet, kids these days are too soft, you know? It's like, what? They're actually children. Children are vulnerable.
They're so vulnerable. I mean, I have, little boys. My youngest, who's six, is like so soft and gooey and sweet and innocent and like, like they start off, we all start off like, you know, these little vulnerable beings. We're human.
They don't not cry when they have a feeling.
No.
You don't see girls crying and boys just being like, doesn't bother me.
Yeah.
No.
They learn that. We teach them that over time. We beat that into them, unfortunately. And that, I've been reading this, what's it called? The Will to Change by Bell Hooks. And she talks about how, like, that kind of, like, we do violence to little boys by beating out this, like, tenderness and vulnerability in them. And then that translates to all kinds of violence, if we think about it. I mean, I know, working with survivors, like, so much of that violence is perpetuated by men. Women pass it on, too. So, but the kind of violence that we're seeing, I mean, thinking about in America right now, like, you know, the constant school shootings and, I mean, all of this is, it's violence, right? That is
political violence, school shootings, violence in communities, domestic violence, sexual violence, all. I mean, I will say, like, in our culture over time, those crime rates are going down, which is good, but the violence isn't just physical assaults. It's not just, you know, sexual violence isn't just rape that you're going to get charged with if anyone believes you and get, you know, someone gets convicted in court, meaning if anyone believes the victim. And that's my cynical many years of sexual violence work that said that. But, you know, what about the whole reality of just walking down the street as a woman? It's objectifying. Our culture is so objectifying, and it objectifies mothers.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. I mean, we exploit mothers, right, for our labor. I mean, we just had, there was, you know, I don't know how political you get here, but like the
bring it on
vice president candidate, Jamie Vance, talked about, you know, when asked about kind of the solution to childcare prices being so hard and how difficult it is for families to access it, you know, his solution is like, we should be asking grandma and grandpa. But like, when we say that, we mean grandma, right? Like, we expect, like, you know, women to, and he talks about his own mother-in-law, Indian woman who came and took care of their kids. And while he got to go work on his career, right? And like, this idea that the solution to systemic problems is like the unpaid labor of women. Like, that's like, even, I mean, of course, we all know that it'd be great to have support from family if you have it. That's kind of obvious, right? But that would even be like, he would, in a, as a politician in this position of power, who is so many more resources and the ability to think, you know, about real solutions. And that was his response, was to say, you know, why don't we just ask grandma, you know, like that, how insulting.
You know what I don't miss at all? That vicious week before my period when I felt like crawling out of my skin. Skin that was breaking out, cravings, ugh. Now it's easier to manage PMS with Estro Control. Estro Control is a formula developed by Happy Mammoth, a supplement company dedicated to making women's lives easier. The way Estro Control eases PMS is quite interesting. The ingredients help support the liver, and that's where our hormones get processed, especially estrogen. So when the estrogen isn't processed well in the liver, women may start having PMS, breaking out, getting cravings, and feeling low all of a sudden. Estro Control is made specifically for women who are premenopausal, so it's perfect for women that haven't entered menopause yet. In fact, it's amazing for perimenopause when hormones start to fluctuate and PMS can turn into a beast. For a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code CHAT at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code CHAT for 15% off today.
Therapist. We've all had that moment. You wake up in the middle of the night. Oh my gosh, did I do my notes? Well, you don't have to worry about that anymore when you use Therapy Notes. Therapy Notes makes it easy to write your notes, get them done quickly, but thoroughly. My group practice has used Therapy Notes for 6 years, and everyone always finds it easy to use. But the best thing is, if you do need help, you can call their customer service number and a person answers the phone. And anytime I've ever had to use it, which is maybe 3 times in the past 6 years, my issue has been resolved easily with a cheerful demeanor in 15 minutes or less. So I highly recommend Therapy Notes. And don't forget, go to therapynotes.com and use promo code CHAT to get 2 free months.
Yes, that's true. And it's also like, it's so, I don't know, it's just a very narrow definition of, they go back to the family values idea, where the family values are that a woman's place is in the home. That's the family value.
Yeah.
You know, and that's not really family values. That's not, is that even what's best for women? If you look at, you know, I mean, women who want to stay home and work inside the home, taking care of their kids and not have other employment that's paid. I have the utmost respect for that. I have never been able to do that either financially or emotionally.
Yeah.
But it's a very privileged stance to even pretend that it's possible for, because the less you have in our culture, I mean, are women who are living in poverty able to be stay-at-home moms? No, they're called quote, welfare queens, right? That's a stay-at-home mom who is poor. I mean, and that's the thing that people like that, who you spoke about, are so staunchly against, you know, that as a problem, instead of realizing that people don't have the opportunity to go to work if they have children and there's no affordable childcare. So they're stuck in poverty. They're not choosing not to work. As if work is a virtuous thing anyway. I mean, why do we have to work to survive? That's
really
wrong with that.
Right.
That's part of our patriarchal culture.
Exactly. I mean, I think that's why it's like, whether or not you want to work, need to work, whatever, feel called
to work.
Choose to work out. And we say work, meaning like for employment, pay, because it's all work, as you and I know.
Like, yes, it is.
It's hard to do either one. I mean, it's hard. Like, part of what really radicalized me was having to put my babies in daycare at 12 weeks full time, because that 12 weeks was all I could get. We scraped. And I mean, at that point in my life, like, to make that even work for maternity leave, because there really wasn't maternity leave, and it was, you know, a combination of, you know, short-term disability and paid time off, and then like some couple weeks of unpaid, you know. And I mean, some people, I think they say like a lot
most
of people
jobs
go back,
do not provide that.
Yeah, they go back at 2 weeks, 4 weeks, you know. And so, like, a lot of, I think it makes sense that a lot of mothers would want to stay home and heal and bond, and are forced into the workforce earlier than they would want. And then others, yeah, like, can't hold a job because, you know, school starts at 9 o'clock and ends at 3:25 or something. And then how are you supposed to make it work? So I just feel like it doesn't work for families. And yet there's this whole like agenda being pushed right now to sort of say that what's best for kids is for mom to be home in this one particular way. And we know that there are many ways to live your life, many ways to have a family, and like, the oppression is not being able to make those choices, which is different for men. We expect that men will work. That's just a given, right? And that's a pressure that I think a lot of men feel, and that they don't feel like they could. I mean, there are lots more dads like becoming stay-at-home dads, and that's like a newer thing, which is pretty brave to kind of step into this role that isn't aligned with our masculine ideas of, and in quotes, men. So we have a long way to go.
You know, you're right, Erin, but I just have to point out, because I literally was talking about this with a client right before we recorded this, how, and this client is more in my age range, middle age, and we were talking about that movie 9 to 5. Do you know that movie? Dolly Parton.
I know the song. I want to sing the song. Fonda. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the movie was about a sexist workplace and women going to work, and the boss was sexually harassing them. And, you know, it was toxic and it was very obvious. I remember, whatever it says about me, I saw the movie in the theater when I was probably like 8, and I knew it was screwed up. Like, I knew it was wrong the way the women were being treated. It was clear. It was obvious. But that was like 1980 or so. And what the client and I were talking about is how in America now, our adult daughters have less rights over their own bodies than we had growing up. And we were born in the 70s. So we are not going, that is not a forward movement. When people say go back to the way things were in the 50s, they're not kidding. Yeah. And that should bother us.
Yeah, it's scary. Like, really, really scary. Yep.
It is.
Yeah.
Well, I'm really grateful for what you're doing to raise awareness in really relatable ways. And I mean, what you share is so on point and so just poignant to me about the experience that a lot of things that I don't think we all even consider, like, when people talk about paid parental leave, and you think about like a country like Sweden, where people get up to what, 2 years paid leave from the birth of a child. And then if another child comes after that, then they would get the same amount for that child. So that means that families can actually be with their kids. And why are these countries consistently rated highest on, you know, happiness and well-being and health? And people say, oh, but their taxes are outrageous. I don't care. Take half what I make. If it means that we have an equal society, I'd be happy to give that.
Yeah.
What do I need to buy that's more important than that? So I need more of my money. I don't want my taxes going to endless wars. I want it to be for the well-being of the people, especially those who need the most support, whether it's children, people who are currently living in poverty because of inequality and structural systemic injustice and oppression. I'm just like, It is time for a change. Long overdue.
Yeah. And I mean, it's interesting, like the values you're talking about, health and well-being, it's like that's actually not reflected in what the sort of the laws are. It's not reflected in kind of in like when you look at what our system is doing, that I don't see that as the goal. I think many of us want that. And I think there's this like, you know, this like super hyper individualistic cowboy mentality, right? That's like kind of, you know, ingrained and sort of like everyone's on their own. Everyone, this like left, it's like unhealed trauma, you know, of saying like, we can't depend on each other. You can't ask for handouts. You can't, you know, it's your kids. You got to take care of your kids yourself. Like, don't expect, like, all of that to me sounds like somebody who could never rely on a person. And that's like in our system. And
it is what the patriarchy's message is don't need help. Do it for yourself. Be strong, be powerful, push through, all in service of just keeping the power in the hands of those who have the most. That's really what it's about. It's not about like creating a just society.
Yes. And like just speaking about the motherhood piece, I think a lot of women, particularly if you have privilege, so if you are white, if you are, you know, have a lot of education, privilege can mean many things. You have an intact, healthy family of origin. Like, I think in a lot
economic sufficiency.
Yep. You may feel like you can kind of thrive or like sort of be successful in that by not depending on anyone, by kind of working hard and taking care of yourself. But when you become a mom, there's like this is such a vulnerable time when most of us need people. You're
biologically, it's normal.
Yeah. And that is where I see a lot of like real fear around being in this vulnerable place of I need people, but I've never been taught how to ask for help. Like that is the worst, right? Like in order to adapt, it's shameful. It's threatening. The way that I survive is to rely on myself, to not be too much, to not need anything. Like all those survival techniques then kind of, they don't work. And so you overfunction, become burnout, or kind of go into despair, or there's all kinds of ways that can get expressed.
Then we call it postpartum depression.
And that's the only label we have to describe it. And I just want to caveat, of course, there is a hormonal component. Of course, there's biological stuff going on, but we overemphasize that when so much can be attributed to this, experience, this loss of freedom, of choices.
Autonomy.
Yeah. And I think I noticed that shift can be almost bigger for folks who've had a lot of privilege and then lose it versus, let's say, like Black women, other women of color, folks who've experienced a lot of systemic trauma. Then it's like compounded. Then it's like you're adding layers of trauma. So it's like almost like a different experience, and it's expressed differently, you know? So it's not great.
Yes, you're right. And, you know, I feel like where we should end is I hope that this conversation will shake people who think things are just fine out of the complacency and say, well, maybe it's not just fine for everyone. And what can I do to be a part of making things better for everyone? If I'm in a more privileged position, how can I use my power to advocate for and vote for what's right and for people whose voices don't get heard by design, not because they have nothing to say or they aren't speaking up, but because they're not allowed to take up space. They're prevented from taking up space. What can I do? And if I'm a man who's, this is stirring anything, like, is it good enough the way it is?
Because, you know, when we look at politics and we look at, for example, the 2016 election, white women and white men did not do so great in voting for a better society, so to speak, for all. And in 2024, we have another chance, and it's really important.
Therapy is political, right? That actually means something. You know, a lot of the things that, you know, we could talk about the psychological experiences that humans have, and that maybe we talk about in therapy, like your family of origin and the experiences you've had. But so much of that is impacted by the society and the political atmosphere that all of this is happening. We have to address the context and try to get to the source. And I think therapists become so politically active because we are sitting with the consequences, hearing what people are dealing with. And, you know, there's things that we can do to help, and there are certain things we can, like, help folks cope with or heal or validate. But if we want to get to the source, there's so much that's, like, in our culture that really, like, makes a difference in how, in our mental health, right? So
exactly. It's like if we knew that the air we were breathing was toxic, we could try to cope with how we feel about having toxic air, and we could try to, you know, get better lung capacity, right? And we could try to, you know, board up our house or somehow, like, insulate everything so that the toxicity doesn't come inside, and get special machines, you know? Or we could just, like, address the toxic air. And that's kind of like our current culture and the way things are. When, you know, you see the police violence, the war, the fear, the political violence, the poverty, inequality, crime. As a sociology minor, and me as a sociology major and a social worker, we know that the solutions are there. They've been researched. They've been identified for many decades. It's not like someone needs to come up with a new solution. It's right there. But it takes the political will, Congress in particular, to protect people's rights and their safety, not continue to strip them away. So, I'm really glad that we talked today. And maybe we can continue this conversation. Maybe we can, because we had a whole bunch of other points that we didn't really get to, because I probably took us in a different direction, but
it flowed here. I know. If you think, like, I sound angry, it's because I am angry. I mean, I've been told that I don't sound super angry, but I am. You know, I think there's reason to be, and it's hard to be angry, and not everyone's in a place to be angry because of all kinds of reasons in their life. So, yeah, I think if folks have that fire that they can ignite and join together to try to, I mean, yes, vote, and also have these conversations with people in your life, because I think there's a lot of, like, unlearning that a lot of us need to do to sort of even address this, our internalized patriarchy, this sort right. of way of thinking about it. And we have to start there, just like any internalized racism, internalized sexism, all of this, it's like, has to start there for us to then influence the external. So,
yeah, I think I can't remember exactly what it was. I'm trying to remember this t-shirt I used to have. It was about sexual violence, but it was like outreach plus action equals something. But I guess it
Justice,
would be change, maybe,
change.
You know, it's like you can feel enraged, but it doesn't have to be disenfranchised rage that has nowhere to go.
Yes.
Mobilize with it and use it to do something different.
Yep.
Talk to people about how you think things should be. You know, get involved. Activism, serving in office. There's yeah. many ways to be involved. Use your platform. If you have a big social media following, like both of us have in one form or another, use it to speak about what you believe in and what you think is right and the way that you think things should be. And if enough of us come together with the right intentions, right heart, care for each other as a society? Now, I think sometimes people think the only answer is a violent, destructive answer, but it's coming together that brings the most power.
I think it's empathy. It's like that's really the heart, is like caring about your fellow neighbor and understanding that we're all walking, you know, slightly different paths, but like we're all human, and having that compassion for each other and compassion for yourself. You know,
we all want to be safe, and we want our children to be safe, and we just want to we want to just live.
Yeah.
Oh,
I don't know
Aaron,
how to wrap it up
you.
In a positive bow. We're just going to sit with the difficult
just
feelings.
Leave it like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
But where can people find you online, and maybe beyond Instagram, what else you offer?
Yeah. Yeah. So you can find me on Instagram at feminist.mom.therapist. I also have a podcast called the Feminist Mom Podcast, and I talk to lots of smart people about the intersection of feminism and motherhood. So definitely check that out. And then, like Laura, I have seen a need for helping connect clients, particularly moms and families, with inclusive providers. So therapists, doulas, like birth workers, lactation consultants. It's like a directory. It's called the Inclusive Provider Directory.
I didn't know you
created
that. Oh, wow. I had no idea.
It's newish. I'm really trying. You know what it's like to figure out how to promote a directory. It's a whole thing.
Yes, I do.
You do. I know you do. So it's my attempt to try to help families find providers who are trauma informed. That's not the way that you have, trauma is the thing, but kind of like trauma informed, but inclusive, identity affirming. And so people can go and search their area, and folks can even, providers can, specify if they are feminist, reproductive rights, pro-rights allied, LGBTQI allied. So just that
beautiful.
Parents and families can really find good care. So that's the inclusive.
So that's for, all these different services around parenting and families. Okay.
Yeah.
And tell us again.
Yep. So that's inclusiveproviders.com.
Fabulous.
And if folks are providers and they align with that, definitely check it out. I'd love for you to join.
Yeah. Okay. I'll include links in the show notes to your podcast, the directory, and your Instagram. And you also, though, provide therapy in Maryland?
Oh, yeah. Yes. I also provide therapy. I am accepting new clients right now. So I am licensed in Maryland and North Carolina. And
oh, great.
Yeah, you can check that out, erinsparrtherapy.com.
Fabulous. Erin, thank you so much for talking with me on Therapy Chat today. I really loved our conversation.
Oh, good. Thank you for having me. This was such a treat.
Try Therapy Notes, the number one rated electronic health record system available today. With live telephone support 7 days a week, it's clear why Therapy Notes is rated 4.9 out of 5 stars on Trustpilot and has a 5-star rating on Google. Therapy Notes makes billing, scheduling, note-taking, and telehealth incredibly easy. And now, for all you prescribers out there, Therapy Notes is proudly introducing ePrescribe. Try it today with no strings attached and see why everyone is switching to Therapy Notes, now featuring ePrescribe. You can get 2 months free by using promo code CHAT at therapynotes.com. Trauma Therapist Network is a website to learn about trauma and how it shows up in our lives and to find a trauma therapist. Go to traumatherapistnetwork.com to find a trauma therapist near you today.
Thank you for listening to Therapy Chat with your host, Laura Regan, LCSWC. For more information, please visit therapychatpodcast.com.